Well, hi, and welcome to this, the sixth episode in the Art Connects podcast series. I'm Nick Corston from Steamco. And this podcast was recorded just a few weeks after the tragic, the untimely passing of Sir Ken Robinson, somebody who inspired me to start Steamco with other parents, businesses and artists. And I know inspired people all over the world in business, in schools and work and the rest of society. A fantastic man. So what better place than to do this podcast here in Liverpool with Mark Featherstone Whitty, a man synonymous with the art, with the culture and the education of the city. We launched Steamco in Liverpool 5 years ago at an event at the Contemporary Urban Centre in the Baltic Triangle area of Liverpool. A fantastic session hosted by the Northern Schools Trust, the Life Sciences UTC, the studio school there. And we were delighted that Sir Ken gave us an interactive interview with him in the States. It was a wonderful thing to experience, and you can check that out on our YouTube channel. This conversation with Mark really has a number of key points, but two that really stood out for me. One was what Nick Gibb, the English schools minister, said to Ken when they met the first and what would prove to be, I think, the last time. And also the man who is tipped, that Mark says is discussing the idea of funding, supporting some sort of memorial or foundation or legacy project for Sir Ken. So a really interesting podcast and some exclusive insights that I'm sure you won't have picked up anywhere else. So really, really excited. And in fact, it's inspired me to produce a series of these podcasts. Sir Ken gave us the talk, and we now need to walk that talk. I gave a talk at the RSA 5 or 6 years ago, which I said it's time to walk the talk for creativity and education. So I'm going to do a breakout series of these podcasts, and I'm going to call it the hashtag TalkWalkers20. Got about 12, 13, maybe more actually, people lined up to contribute to that. People who knew Sir Ken, people who worked with him, people who were inspired by him. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. If you enjoy this, and if you want to get hold of that podcast, be sure to subscribe to these podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, on iTunes, on Google Podcasts, Deezer, Spotify, SoundCloud, whatever, it gets served out to all of them. Subscribe, please vote, please rank them, please put some comments in. And if you really want to be part of this, why don't you send us a little sound clip, a little voice file of what you thought of this session or other previous podcasts. We have Matthew Taylor from the RSA, Kirsty Williams, the Welsh Education Minister, who's rolling out a curriculum founded in creativity. And also Richard Gerver, who's a very close associate of Sir Ken's as well. So do stay tuned, do lock on, do tell us what you think, and do get involved. Be part of it with your art. I hope you enjoy this. Okay, so welcome to the latest edition of the Art Connects podcast, the A to Z of art. And this is L. This is L for Liverpool, a very special place for us, a very special place for anybody, because it's a city where community, where culture, where creativity really are the lifeblood of the city and almost everybody in it. I'm delighted today to be joined by a very special person who several years ago launched a thing called the British Record Industry Trust, the Brit School down in Croydon. That was in the south of England. He then moved to Liverpool to found an organisation called the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts. I'm not sure if that's Lipper or Leaper, but I'm sure he's just about to tell me. Mark Featherstone Whitty, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome. Tell us a little bit about Leaper and your work here at the moment.
Well, the I'll try and combine what you said about Lipper Nick and the Brit School. The whole thing started for me watching a movie in London in the early 80s, which was Alan Parker's film Fame, which was about a performing arts school in New York. What I decided to do after seeing the film and being very energized by the energy in the film was to start talking to people within the creative and performing arts world who were survivors and ask them all quite a simple question. And that was, when you left, because that was, I was thinking of starting a school then, which indeed the Brit School was. The question I asked them, which was a simple one, was, what do you wish you had known when you left school? which you then had to learn the hard way. What would be on the curriculum? So that is kind of one area, which we can talk about, Nick. And the other area is how you're going to teach it. I think those are the two most important things. What are you going to teach and how you're going to teach it? There were a couple of remarks which stayed with me. There were lots of people I discussed this with. One was from George Martin, who some of you may know was the producer of the Beatles records. And he pointed me in the direction that it was important that everyone involved in putting on an event or any kind of event appreciated what other people were bringing to the party, as it were. So I began to think, yes, we need to start institutions where all the disciplines interact with each other. That was the first fundamental idea. The second one came from a singer-songwriter called Joan Armour Trading. And she pointed out to me, or she told me, that when she was signing her first record contract, she was the only one in the room who didn't know what was going on. So the second lesson from that was that everybody going into the creative and performing arts really needed to learn about business. After all, it is called show business for a reason. And the other person who I've known Ken for in quite a long time, we can talk about him as well, but his vision of education had a profound effect as well. And I'm not sure it was completely from Ken, but he participated in that. But I also had from him and others the need to provide education or learning which had meaning. Those are the three things right at the very, very beginning.
That's fantastic. So making education relevant to people's lives seems a major theme there.
Well, that's right. I mean, I sometimes say to people, I mean, I'm now 74 and I can still recite the present tense of I love in Latin, but it's never got me a date.
Maybe not in Liverpool, maybe in Rome.
Well, why was I learning that stuff? I simply don't know.
It's interesting. And I know that when we were in Liverpool last year, actually, we had a whole week in the city for our Art 19 week. And, you were generous enough to join us on a panel to discuss the movie Most Likely to Succeed.
Yes, wonderful.
Which very much focuses on vocational learning and project-based learning as well. What do you remember from that, and how that might ground back into what you've just said about relevance of education to young people?
Well, I think my fundamental thing is I think all of us respond to challenge, and it really could be any challenge. It doesn't necessarily have to be the creative and performing arts, but in sorting out a challenge, it's invigorating, and there are a lot of things that you can learn while trying to sort out a challenge which you don't realise you're learning. We sometimes call it encouraging children to eat their greens. along the way, you pick up a lot of skills, but the thing that's pushing you forward is a tangible event. This is what the film was about, wasn't it, Nick? A tangible product or which turns people on. I remember that exhibition at the end of the film and how proud youngsters were looking at what they'd created. And in the process of creating those wonderful artifacts, they learnt a whole range of other skills.
There was a line in that film, wasn't there, Most Likely to Succeed, where I think it was the principal of the school said it's all about the feeling of making something that wasn't there before.
Exactly.
And the pleasure of showcasing it to your community and that experience.
That's right.
Which for me is a large part of what you were doing at the Brit School, teaching young people and giving them the skills, but also the context for those skills in a business world. I must admit, when you said when you described a second objective for the Brit School, I wondered if you were going to talk about Joan Armatrading, the actual mechanics of how it works, some of the technology and the techniques and the production processes. Is that possibly a third strand in terms of the practicality of that education?
Well, the interesting thing I learned later, Nick, was, I mean, it varies between disciplines, but the interesting thing I learned later was that 76% of those in the creative and performing arts world are self-employed. I hadn't realized it was, I mean, it's different. There are different percentages depending on what you're doing. Designers, for instance, it's 83%. Managers, it's 46%. But broadly speaking, three quarters of the people working in this specific sector are their own businesses, which of course have been brutally affected by the pandemic that we're living through, which is a particular example of how that this particular sector works. There are very few people, well, a quarter of the whole sector, who actually have regular jobs.
And it is an industry where the actual business model has changed drastically in the last particularly 10 years, hasn't it? Where once upon a time there were gatekeepers, which are the record industries, the movie houses, and now increasingly a lot of those revenues have disappeared through the streaming models, the payment for the intellectual property that creatives are developing. And it strikes me that the young people that have been lucky enough to be educated with your colleagues at the Brit School and at Lipa, will have possibly been a bit more entrepreneurial. I saw on Wikipedia that you're actually described as an entrepreneur as well as a creative and an artist yourself. Those skills may have proved invaluable to those musicians, those artists today who've realised platforms like Patreon and new ways of generating some income themselves and, if you like, cutting out the middleman in the short term. Have you seen examples of that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was just looking the other day. I mean, about 170 businesses have. I mean, look, if you're working for yourself, you know, you're handling your promotion, you're handling your obviously tax affairs, you've got obviously some sort of handle on your legal affairs. I mean, it doesn't suit everyone, this. The wonderful thing about coming to a place like ours, and I'm sorry if I'm trying to talk about Lipa for a moment, but is that you will meet everyone you ever need. So if you don't want to do it, if you're a performer or an artist of some kind, you can team up with other people who are sitting alongside you who can do that very thing for you. And if you are, I say in a slightly cheesy way, Nick, for youngsters who arrive for the first time, I say, well, I couldn't do it this year because they weren't near enough to be able to sit next to each other. But I said, you know, shake the hand of the person next door to you. They may turn out to be your first employee, or they may be employing you. That's what happens. And some of our most, I mean, financially successful businesses that have come from here have a bigger turnover than we do. And we're sort of both annoyed and very proud about that. Yes, 170 businesses. But actually, funnily enough, the other thing, Nick, to say is that some of them are not performing arts ones. They've started up restaurants and cafes and all sorts of things because these are all tremendously transferable skills. That's what I meant by saying it doesn't really matter what the project is. You need to get a grip of the process. And we do a little sort of task on this. That process is as important as what the task is. And once you learn the process, you can apply it in any number of environments, can't you?
Gosh, so much there, Mark.
We could spend many hours, couldn't we?
Maybe this is the first of many episodes. Yeah. Transferable skills, absolutely. I think what I loved there was the way that you're teaching young people to look beyond the obvious and to be proactive and look for opportunities and those human connections amongst each other.
That's right.
And this isn't about looking for what you can get out of people, but this is the Art Connects podcast, and we've named it after a phrase we got from Seth Godin, big thinker. Art is what we call it when what we do might connect us. We're leaving the industrial economy, and this is now a connection economy where technology and people and creativity are absolutely key. And to hear you describing it in that way is fantastic.
That's right.
And I know that any young person that's lucky enough to come to Lipa gets those connections and jump started. And we'll come back to that. You've fascinated me now, Mark. So I didn't spend enough time reading your Wikipedia page. So maybe give us a little snapshot of what you were doing, because you don't struck me as someone who's kicking his heels until he started the Brit School. So what's your potted CV up to that point?
Well, it was a mess, to be honest, Nick. It was a mess. I mean, like a lot of people, I mean, I don't know why, but I wasn't somebody who left school and knew what they wanted to do. The only thing I remember about leaving school was that right at the very end of my time at school, and I'm sorry about talking when you're sort of in your teens, but these are very formative years.
No, not at all.
This
is what I asked you to do.
And also, I also, if I could say, I do feel the focus on education is in completely the wrong sector, because I think energy and money and time should be spent on primary education over, indeed, secondary education. If one had to choose, and one only had a limited amount of money, primary is absolutely key, which is one of the reasons why we started a primary school. But I decided towards the end of my time at school, which I wasn't happy at, to put on a play. And I was I did something which was stupid. I acted in it. I cast myself, which was mad. I produced it. I directed it and all the rest of it. And I really wanted and thought I was going to be an actor. And lots of people do. It was only a long, long time later that I realized that actually it wasn't the acting thing that interested me that much, so much as putting on something which had never been put on before. It was just the very act of, I mean, it wasn't very creative in the sense the play was already written, but the act of just mounting something fresh and producing something which wasn't on a stage before, I found tremendously exciting. And I found it very exciting, it may seem odd to say this, when I began starting small businesses. And I was absolutely, Nick, I mean, my first thing was, this sounds very odd to say this, was just creating the letterhead. I thought, if I get the letterhead, that makes it sort of feel real. And there it is. And I would design the lettering and with letter set.
I was going to say it's a letter set project, that is. I've yeah. been there, done that. And absolutely.
Yeah. And well, you with your, I mean, it's true in your life. I mean, you've started this wonderful steam enterprise, and it is very invigorating. It's tiring, of course, because you're the only one who's doing it. And once you, I say to people here that once you, you know, go to sleep at night, the thing dies, and it all depends on you and what the motivation you have to do it. But I suppose that would, I'm trying to cut a lot of years out because, as I've said, I'm not young anymore. But that's what was, I suppose, going all the way back. That was the thing that started it. Just creating something fresh.
It's back to the lessons from Most Life Goes to Succeed, isn't it? That wonderful movie.
Yes.
And one of the things that's brought us back together a year since we last saw each other was the tragic passing of Sir Ken Robinson, and we'll come on to that. Sir Ken featured in that film and I thought provided some fantastic punctuation through that. And I don't know if you know, that film was produced by a chap called Ted Dintersmith. I don't know if you've come across him. And he's
I'm afraid I have. Right.
So basically, a couple of years ago, he announced an educational project with Sir Ken, which we're hoping is actually going to provide a large part of the legacy. So watch this space. He was the backer behind that movie, a venture capitalist from America who's as passionate about education as you are from a slightly different perspective, maybe more business perspective. But
talking about legacy and so on, I have heard that is it Jeff Bezos? Is that the right?
Oh, well, from the Amazon chap.
This fabulously rich man.
I was going to say he's not short of a future, Bob, is he?
No, he isn't. And I've heard that it is. He has in mind to start up a Robinson Foundation. So right. let's see what happens there. I know no more than that.
Maybe it'll be on Mars because he builds rockets as well, doesn't he? Gosh, if you find any more about that, let me know. So fantastic background. I mean, believe it or not, I'm actually live on BBC Radio Shropshire today, and I'm going to have to tell them all about the fact that I made model railways as a child in Ludlow in Shropshire. And
well,
there's a model of Ludlow Railway Station in Ludlow Museum, which I contributed to. I was quite surprised to see that last year. So that's my claim to fame. And I do love that production and the opportunity to get involved. And I think, as you say, this is why drama, the performing arts, are so important in our schools, because they're the ultimate transferable skills. I was lucky enough to have art and drama. I was also a butcher's boy, and I learned more in that butcher's shop on a Saturday morning than I learned doing Latin, as you say. So fast forward, you did the Brits.
I mean, it could be Nick. I mean, at one time I was put on a panel. I can't quite work out why, but I was put on a panel for youngsters to join a ship which was sailing around the world, and at various points this ship would dock, and they'd get involved in various social benefit schemes in the countries where this particular, and they had a sort of, I think it was called a selection weekend, and they would have tasks. This goes back to the whole idea of challenge. There'd be a Land Rover in a ditch, and the youngsters would be presented with this Land Rover in a ditch and told, okay, you've got to get it out of the ditch. How are you going to do it? Off you go.
Problem solving, I mean, critical skills, communication, collaboration,
you know, we concentrate on the creative and performing arts, but I think, as Ken would say, you can be creative in any discipline.
Well, absolutely. I'm dying to talk back to Ken, but I just want to get the context from you, because I think your background is fantastic. And So Lipper, I mean, you started the Brit School. That was a resounding success. Was Richard Branson involved in that? Did I read as well?
That's right. Yes, he was the project champion, Nick. And I think you always need project champions in the sense that you're obviously, you know, not well known and nobody really cares that much about you, but you have to get people attached to projects. Well, you know this in your project, who people will lift up the telephone for. Oh, gosh, you know, this is a call from Richard Branson. Mark Featherstone won't really count for anything very much. So he was enormously helpful.
Well, how does that work? Because I always imagine that people like Richard Branson are fantastic. They've got 20 personal appearances to do in a day, a couple of piles of letters to sign. I mean, how do you actually focus that? Or was he genuinely passionately behind it? And really, was he picking the phone up to you? Or was it a sort of 5 minute in his diary over a 10-year period? Fascinating, the role that someone like that can play. Because they're so
Well, you're completely right. And Richard, at that particular point in his life, was quite disorganized. And
you made
charming.
A couple then, did you?
It was charming. I mean, I don't know whether you know this, but his office was a boat on the canal in
very near
in,
here, actually. Yeah,
Duendi, I think his boat was That's called, right. and it was. It's so disarming to step on board a sort of canal boat, and here's this sort of man who, as everybody knows who he is, but it was he's had a wonderful way about him, and. It was interesting. Now I think about it. It was George who introduced me to Richard.
Right. Okay. So, and that's
I would never have met him, but for George.
And I think a lot of people can easily forget Richard Branson's background in the music business. And obviously, Virgin was just up the road, the Harrow Road. We actually started Steamco in a primary school, St Saviour's, in Little Venice, Paddington. Just literally 100 yards from Richard Branson's boat. It's never occurred to me to go and knock on the door, actually. Maybe that's why I've been going wrong. Maybe that's why I'm sat here talking to you. But I wouldn't be anywhere else. So fast forward, what brought you to Liverpool? And tell us about Lipper. Was it?
Well, what brought me to Liverpool was very simple. I'd, having got the blueprint and got the... for the Brit School, they needed to advertise for a principal or a head teacher of the school. I applied I didn't get it, which was a very low moment. And particularly since all the people who were interviewing me wouldn't have been there but for the fact that it was my fucking idea. But anyway, never mind.
Where's my beep button? Beep!
At that point, I can only tell you, Nick, it was absolute. I think, we could talk a lot. We could have another conversation about the luck that plays in people's lives and the ability.
Serendipity.
And the ability to. I mean, Ken always had the view that luck is happening all the time. and perhaps to everyone, he says, and perhaps the thing which marks out those who do well is they spot it and others don't. But nevertheless, it was the case. I was then thinking, I was actually appointed to do something. I was given a post actually in the Brit School, which never actually materialised. So that was that. And then what happened was, by sheer chance, Paul was writing a classical piece called the Liverpool Oratorio.
Paul
McCartney.
Oh, beg your pardon. Right. Of course, yeah, Paul McCartney. Right.
Yeah, I was writing a piece called Liverpool Oratorio, which is about a boy growing up in Liverpool. And quite a large section of that oratorio was his time at school. So Paul decided in the middle to come up to his old school, which is where we are now, in the middle of the night. It was literally in the middle of the night, and did a wonderful black and white film. But that wasn't the point. What he was trying to do was to reminisce about his own school days and wander around this derelict building. And after he had done that...
Gosh, it was derelict, was it?
He was allowed. It was actually the trustee at the time was Liverpool City Council. And it was just sitting plonked there because this happened to be a building which was built in the course of the 19th century. And you couldn't just sort of sell it for bus shelters. I mean, it had to have a use for it. And any money, even if you did sell it, would go back to the original trust, which was, as I said, formed in the 19th century. So nobody could get hold of any. It wasn't realizable as for money at all. So what was going to happen to it? And Paul mentioned this to George, and George said, "Well, I'm involved with this thing in London called the Brit School, and Mark is leading that. Why don't you have a chat with him?" And that's how this started. It was as serendipitous as that. If he hadn't been writing his oratorio, if he hadn't come around the school, none of this would have been possible.
I always say to friends in Ludlow who say, "I'm lucky for the life I've had," you don't get lucky sitting at home watching Sky Sports. You know, you just got to get out there, haven't you, and make those connections and live your life.
Well, I'm with you, Nick. I'm like a at various points in my life, I'm like a, no, it's not a really very good metaphor, but I'm like a machine gun. I just spray bullets everywhere and hoping one will land. Sorry, that would be killing people, wouldn't it? I don't mean that. Maybe I'd think of another metaphor. I can't think of it very quickly. But you're quite right. I mean, you've got to put yourself out there in order for people to know who you are and respond to you.
Absolutely. And I think there are times when one's got to write a plan and a strategy, and the times you've just got to go with the flow. And we ran that a week in Liverpool with like 3 weeks notice last year after John Moores University said that they'd be happy to collaborate with some slots they had. And you've just got to seize the opportunities. You have too much too set in stone. You can't seize those opportunities as they come along.
That's right. So you're completely right.
So what's the elevator pitch for Lipa then? If you've got some prospective parents coming along and you just happen to catch them in the lift, how would you sell it to them and convince them that their young person should be joining you?
I suppose this is a chance for people to participate in a mini and protected version of the reality they will face when they leave. In other words, we've tried and reproduce the world of work as much as we can within a educational environment.
The world of the creative industries specifically.
That's right.
And how broad is your definition of the creative industries?
I suppose the simple one. I mean, it could be very broad, couldn't it, Nick? Because there's so many skills allied to it. But at the heart are the skills for putting on a show. So you've got musicians, you've got actors, you've got dancers, you've got sound tech people, you've got theatre tech people, you've got theatre design, you've got costume design, you've got front of house. So those would be at the heart of it. We also actually have a applied theatre and community arts, which is a bit of an outlier, to be honest, but also very important because it connects us with Liverpool in a way no other discipline does.
And I'll be honest with you, without wanting to sound too sycophantic, I'm sold on the leadership. Any school, any higher education establishment is only as good as its staff. Give me a flavour.
That's right.
I mean, I've seen that people like Keith Mullen, Ken Mullen from the Farm,
yes,
is a member of your faculty. So he's got a background in a rock band, The Farm, a local legend in the city there. I mean, have you got any other examples of the sort of people that you've managed to join your faculty? And
oh yes, I mean, we've got Eddie London who's one half of China Crisis. We've got the drummer from Elbow. Yeah. I mean, what we try and do is have as many people. I've come to the conclusion, Nick, you can't really. I don't think you can be authentic unless you've done it. So all the people here, we would say, would be qualified by their life experiences. The next thing we have to do is to invite all of them, and if they haven't ever taught before, we insist they learn some teaching skills, which we will pay for, because otherwise you end up with. I remember a long time ago when I was trying to start the Brit School, meeting a wonderful man called Vangelis. I don't even remember him. He was one of these polyglot people who that's exactly right. And he reminded me one of the worries about involving professional people from various disciplines could be they just try and produce mini versions of themselves, which, of course, is the absolute antithesis of teaching. Because when you're teaching, you should be bringing other people out into what they can do rather than asking them to do what you do and do very well, because you already exist. So there's no point in them copying you. So I think teaching is, as indeed parents have discovered, having had their children at home, teaching is a real skill.
Absolutely. And so they're very much teaching curriculum and not just coming in relating past experiences and giving business advice and connections. They very much
We do that as well. We do a bit of that. Yeah, we do a bit of that. We have people coming in. What can you tell us from your experiences? We do that. Those tend to be one-off things. And we do quite a lot of those. I'm talking about the regular teaching staff, as it were. Yeah, that's right, Nick.
So that's your teaching staff. And then I've also seen, it looks as if you have a network of ambassadors, because I saw that Niall Rogers, who did a video call with us from New York when we were in the school in Tonsdorf last year, he seems to be connected somehow with you. And I know he's very fond, he spoke very fondly of Liverpool in that interview.
Yes, he'd be one of the people who came along in one of our conversations, because we do invite people to come for conversations. And what did we have recently? I've forgotten. We had Stephen Fry, who I completely fell in love with. And I just wish he'd been my teacher when I was younger. I tell you who was wonderful. Also relatively recently was Gary Barlow, who was wonderfully articulate, because one of the things he helped us understand. Well, we're very exercised by the whole area of talent and how much or how little do you need in order to be good at what you're doing. And our view, and he exemplified it, he said very sweetly he had a little bit of talent, but he stretched that talent. So how do you stretch talent? And that became very interesting to us. And it's a mixture of exactly what we've been talking about, Nick, and that is giving yourself challenges all the time, either through education or even personal challenges. And he told us a little story about him being given a little keyboard when he was, I think, eight or nine for Christmas. And by the evening, he'd learnt he'd never touched a keyboard before. He knew how to play eight, and he could do it with his little hands. But there was a moment about a few months later when he'd learned everything this keyboard can give him. So his parents took him to a shop and said, well, what's the next thing? What's the next thing up from this? And they bought him a Yamaha organ, which had, had two sets of keyboards. It had, the melody and the treble, and of course the stuff at the bass as well. And that is a wonderful example of, as the Japanese would put it, getting better at getting better. Always presenting yourself with a challenge, because that's one of our very strong things, because you've got to. And not many people want to, but you've got to move outside your comfort zone. and move beyond. And it's you know, trying to get the balance between courage and fear and all the things which make life interesting.
And this very much kicks into touch any idea that the creative subjects, creative education are a light touch. I mean, very, very hard work. And these are character forming. I think one of the loveliest things that I've experienced coming to Liverpool, we did some work with the Blackie Community Arts Centre there. Fantastic bunch of people. And also the Flow, the Florence Centre, the Community Arts Centre down there in Toxteth, near I know where you live. The Flory, that's right, the Flory, sorry. Which I know that Ricky Tomlinson is patron of, and the CEO there is an amazing dynamo of a woman, fantastic. And I mean, this for me is what Ken Robinson has always advocated. The creativity and creative subjects are so important for character building, transferable skills, helping children, helping young people find something they want to be great at, and helping them follow that dream. That element, as he called it. I mean, what's been your experience working with Sir Ken on that? Around those subjects in his areas.
Well, that's why, I mean, that's why, Nick, it's obviously important. I mean, I know this is a cliche, but it's obviously important that the curriculum that youngsters face is a broad and balanced one. Because how else can you find out what actually turns you on unless you have a chance of experiencing it? And I thought was absolutely extraordinary. I'll share this with you. The people listening, and that is that I asked Ken one of the last times I saw him, if he'd met the schools minister. This is a man called Nick Gibb, and he told me he had. And the first words out of Mr. Gibb's mouth was, "So you're the enemy." Now that is so sad and so appalling, because what right do people like Mr. Gibb or Mr. Gove or any of these people have to dictate what youngsters, that what is important and what is not important? We're all so different. And our primary school, for instance, is not a stage school, Nick, but it's suffused by the creative and performing arts. And they might choose, and we were trying to start a high school at the moment, and we've got a sixth form, which is specialist for creative and performing arts. But people should have a broad range, youngsters should have a broad range of choice. Otherwise, they'll never know what turns them on. So that would very much come from Ken, I think.
Well, I'll be honest, I'm still reeling from what you've just said, actually. I've heard similar anecdotes, but that really... And by enemy of him, enemy of children, the economy...
I have no idea. I have no idea. That's all he told me. I interpreted it in terms of the curriculum, because right. The government seems to be obsessed, as they were in the States, by... sort of STEM disciplines, and of course you've that's why you've called your outfit STEAM, in order to stress the importance of the arts. But Ken always said, yes, STEM disciplines are important, but they're not sufficient.
Well, I must admit, I'm flabbergasted. My background, 20, 30 years in the creative industries, advertising, internet marketing, engineering, a whole range of work experience and career paths I've been down, and my life was changed, I think, round about the time I turned 50, when I saw Ken's TED Talk. I read half of a colleague of his, Professor Guy Claxton's book called What's the Point of School, which is a provocative enough title in itself. And I went to a creativity festival, a festival called Camp Bestival, and thought, how do we bring this back to my kids' school and ultimately to others? And that's what we're doing. We're trying to run creative experiences, mini festivals in schools.
Wonderful.
And I thought, well, given thank you. So given that 300 million people have watched that TED Talk, I thought, what better person to latch onto than somebody like that? Because creativity had driven my career. I'd come from a place where I worked for the world's biggest advertising agency network. I'd sold one of my agencies to them, a little digital agency. It all sounds very flash, but I was just glad to get out of the... You probably heard about the dot-com crash, but I was just glad to have a shirt on my back when I walked away to the... But what really struck me, there was an article in the Times Education Supplement. We launched STEAMCO in Liverpool. We had regional launch events Liverpool at the CUC there with Nigel Ward and his schools. And the week of that, it just turned out that Sir Ken published the book Creative Schools. And I was delighted and I contacted him and said, yeah, we'd be delighted to do an interview. So he did an interview from the States about his life in Liverpool and the book. 3 days before that, there was a review of the book in the Times Education Supplement, which is probably the most respected magazine for teachers, educators, leaders.
Yes.
And the reviewer said, I've read the book, you don't need to read it, it's a load of all rubbish. Sir Ken Robinson is a butcher given a ticker tape parade by the National Union of Pigs.
Sorry, who said this?
I'd rather not name the name at the moment, but it was a contributor to the Times Education Supplement, who is now Nick Gibbs' behaviour czar.
Oh,
ironically,
really?
If you look him up on the Mail on Sunday website, they actually reference that he used to run a bar in Soho and lost his public entertainment licence because he wasn't capable of managing a crowd. So here he is, the government's behaviour czar. Now, the whole behaviour conversation in schools is another podcast. And I thought, my goodness, what is it? And I looked into it. And I found that the whole subject of creativity, let alone Ken Robinson, is toxic to a certain segment in education. And I've actually traced this whole thing back through some fairly shadily funded think tanks. And there's a lovely phrase, actually. Our whole education policy at the moment was actually inspired by somebody a lot of people considered a terrorist 10 years ago. You probably may or may not know this. But that terrorist was a chap called Nelson Mandela. He was known as a terrorist in the 80s by some people in the government. His strapline was, the most powerful weapon which we have to change the world with is education. And two people started an education 10 years ago in British education. They started narrowing the curriculum many feel. And that was Michael Gove and his special advisor, a chap you may have heard of called Dominic Cummings. So they set our education strategy up 10 years ago, and maybe the creativity crisis that the creative industries are talking about, maybe the education crisis that school leaders are talking about, retention, funding, narrowing of the curriculum, broken children, mental wellness, well-being, maybe the democracy crisis, I don't know, but it all comes back to that, I don't know, but I have always struggled to understand why people would vilify, not just Ken Robinson, maybe people don't like Scousers, I don't know, but to vilify somebody who's advocating creativity that we know fuels the economy, it makes lives better. And as I say, in Liverpool, you've got working class kids with nothing going to the Florey for music lessons. And I've seen it. It's a beautiful sight, down to the Blackie on a Saturday for free art classes. And lucky enough, children, young people from all over the country coming to you. What are your thoughts around this battle against creativity? Why is creativity such a toxic word, Mark? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't answer that question because I don't know these people and I haven't, thank God, met them yet. So I haven't had any conversation with them. But I tell you what, Nick, there's a lot of hope because I'm at the moment I'm reading it's rather dense. Ken was a, of course, one of the things, wonderful things about Ken was he's such a brilliant communicator. And you read people who are writing in the same area that he's writing, and you realise they're not quite as good as that, although they have interesting things to say. And I'm just completing a book at the moment. I started it over the weekend by a man called David Goodhart called Head, Hand and Heart. I don't know whether you've come across that.
I've just heard about that this morning, yeah.
But in his, he divides human aptitudes into three. The head, which is the cognitive part, the hand, which is manual and craft, and the heart, which is caring and emotional. And of course, we have to have all three to be a reasonable society. But his contention is that it's got badly out of kilter, largely because the cognitive part has become the gold standard of human esteem. And the cognitive class, as he says, now shapes society in its own interests by prioritising the knowledge economy, the ever-expanding higher education, and shaping the very idea of what is a successful and enjoyable life. And to put it bluntly, he says, smart people have become too powerful. And another book has come out relatively recently called The Meritocracy is Unfair, The Tyranny of Merit by a man called Michael Sandel. So if we just take those examples and the response they are getting, not only in the press, but amongst educationalists, is absolutely resonates with what Ken has to say. And I'm very encouraged that people are starting to realise. I mean, Ken's main thing was, and we talked about the broad and balanced curriculum, is the very narrow way we've interpreted people's human capacities. And why is it that when you know, at the end of schooling, you just get pictures in the press, and the press aren't helpful at all. You get pictures in the press of girls normally leaping up with their A-level results or whatever, and they're going to prestigious universities. But you never get pictures of a girl, for instance, who has got her dream job in a beauty salon or as a hairdresser. These are all valuable, traits.
Or bricklayer. And,
that's right. And I think it's quite interesting. I mean, the pandemic is teaching us something, isn't it, Nick? That what you know, suddenly become the phrase key workers, which we hadn't really come across before, have we? Are people who are not generally talked about or recognised in society as a whole, and yet our lives depend on them. So the dignity of work needs to be corrected too. There are too many people being dismissed by those in power as being unimportant, which is of course completely wrong. We're all in it. We're all in it together.
The closest explanation for it for me is around social justice, without wanting to get too political, but I think one has to be able, we don't do party politics at Steamco, but we do comment on policy that affects creativity, community and children's futures. Quite. And you could argue if the robots are going to take a lot of jobs, what is the point of spending austerity pennies on education that, if you only think the purpose of education is for employment, you're wasting money. If we reposition the role of education, then suddenly we can justify spending on creating and educating people to live a full life, to contribute to society, and to back to the thing that you were referring to, that we care. We were clapping for people who care for other people, and that's got to be a future, hasn't it, caring.
And I've forgotten the percentage, Nick, but I think for the creative and performing arts, it's in the high 80s, which are not capable of being reproduced or supplanted by artificial intelligence.
Absolutely.
These are all skills which are absolutely quintessentially human, and only humans can do them.
Robot-proof jobs. Just one thing that's, I mean, it's creativity. I mean, are you familiar with the Festival 2022 that was announced?
Well, to be absolutely honest, I wasn't until you pointed it out to me.
I didn't know I had, actually.
I was very glad to read that £120 million is being put towards this thing. We look forward to it. And I was thinking, you know, how would one do it if one was in charge of it? And it's got to happen, of course, absolutely at the grassroots, doesn't it?
I'm glad to hear you saying that, because it last week or the week before, and there was an announcement about the first stage of ideation and creative development, and they're now looking for 30 organisations, 30 teams, each of which will be paid £100,000 to develop ideas over a three-month period, and then 10 of those ideas will be chosen as national projects. And I got very excited when I saw that, because all the work we've done in the last 2 years, running around like a crazed loon with our little van, doing T-shirt printing and pop-ups here, has been to show what we might do at grassroots with a little bit of resource, and get maybe 10, 20, 50 people like me, wind them up and off they go for 2022.
Exactly.
And I expressed quite some excitement about that. And it was absolutely trolled and shot down on Twitter by people who said there is nothing positive about the festival of Brexit. We will organise and oppose it, which was a view that I agreed with. If you actually felt it was the festival of Brexit, if you felt this is an opportunity to celebrate creativity, to promote creativity to the world, to reconnect our broken society, culture, art and culture, surely it's not such a bad thing. And
of course
not. Such a shame.
Well, I do think I'm not. I mean, I went through a miserable period, a very difficult period recently when the whole Black Lives Matter thing kicked off. Stephen Fry's very good. Stephen's very good on this. Actually, what you get in social media, it seems to me, you get people standing on, how do you describe it, on either sides of the Grand Canyon, shouting at each other. They're not interested in debate or reaching common ground. They just simply want to oppose or promote whatever it is. And the vast majority of people, like you and lots of people I know, are in the middle trying to work out what is the best thing to do. And there's a wonderful line somewhere I think it's a poet who said, you know, the problem with people who have certainty is they're idiots. The people who are good are beset with doubt. and it's you always hear from extremists, not from people who are trying to work out what is the best thing to do. And I've got tired of extremists, right and left.
Well, I'm glad you. I'm flattered to be called somebody who's in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, because to be honest, I actually took a very deliberate stance 2 or 3 years ago to stand on one side and shout very loudly against people who are calling people like Ken Robinson a butcher. To shout against people who say that creativity is for people with glasses who lie. That was somebody's avatar on Twitter.
Right.
And I've said, I'm sorry, but I'm standing up for this because I believe in it. I believe it's right. And it's cost me dearly. It's cost me funding opportunities. A lot of organisations look the other way. And I'm going to stand in the middle of that. That canyon now, because I've realised that the people on the extreme are almost as bad as the people on either side, as you say, and they're
exactly
both...
and also Nick, you've wasted a lot of time engaging in those debates, because they're not going to, you know, and I always say to people, if you really want to, I mean, anybody listening to this, if you really want to have an effect on the world, then try and join your local school as a school governor, or do something really practical. And get involved. Don't spend your time arguing and shouting at people. It's pointless. It's a waste of time. They're not going to be converted by you. You're not going to be converted by them. Just get on and do something positive and practical.
Well, I was going to ask you actually, if finally, because I know you've got to go off, you've got to head off now. But I was just going to ask you,
thank you,
of your final thoughts around Ken Robinson. And to be honest with you, I think you've actually subconsciously said it, because I think Ken Robinson was an advocate and a champion of respect, of mutual respect. He never threw ad hominem comments at anybody else. He was always respectful of different sides. What memories might you have of Ken, just to finish with now? And are there any little moments that you'll take as we celebrate and celebrate his life and his work?
Well, before I talk about that, I mean, I was thinking back to his original TED talk, which was over 26 years ago now, I think, or was it 27 years ago now, and the which everyone's very familiar with, the wonderful Gillian Lynn story, and the thing which struck me about that when I heard it was the comment that Ken made: she had to dance to think. And Ken introduced me to Howard Gardner, which was Frames of Mind. And basically, we're going back to the key thing about, you know, human capacity. We've got a very narrow view of that. About Ken, it isn't just Ken, of course. I've known his family too, because he's had lots of brothers. And we met intermittently over 40 years, Nick, and every time it was one of those relationships which you just start up again where you left off. And it was like a conversation in the background you were having with him and with your life, and what you were trying to do and believed in. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Well, I think we'll leave it there, Mark. Thank you so much.
All right.
Really, really lovely. Really appreciate your time.
Not at all.
So there you go. That was a fantastic chat there with Mark Featherstone Whitty from Lipper. What a great guy, and some interesting insights there. And it's fantastic when people are prepared to be so honest with their input. And also interesting, some of the areas that he wasn't aware of. And I think we've got to just take this conversation out there to everybody. As I say, I hope you enjoyed this. This has inspired me now to go and record a whole bunch of Talk Walkers 20 podcasts. In memory of Sir Ken, talking to people who knew him, who worked with him, and certainly were inspired by him. So be sure to subscribe, to vote, to rank, to share, and record a little sound file and send it in. Your turn at steamco.org.uk. Thanks for listening. Your support means a lot.